netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our guest this week is Weta FX VFX supervisor Guy Williams, and he's here to discuss the VFX of Superman, directed by James Gunn. Now, Mike and Guy discuss a lot of things, including several key sequences, including the one-shot action sequence featuring Mr. Terrific's Groove-Fu fight choreography, the complex pocket universe with its crystalline structures and thousands of prison cells, the creation of the river made of impossible math that took nearly a year to perfect, as well as other challenges from the film. Before we cross that conversation, I just want to remind those of you watching on YouTube to hit the subscribe button, and you'll be automatically notified whenever we post a new Video FX Podcast. Okay, so let's go ahead and join the conversation now between Mike and Guy.
So, Guy, congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
It's great to see you doing these. I love them, but in particular, there's this sort of signature piece that now seems to be so looked forward to and so impressive, which are these incredible one-off shots. I remember discussing it on Guardians, and I guess it's a funny thing to revisit a cinematic style like that in such a different way. But was that always going to be included in this film?
It wasn't trying to be this as much of a centerpiece as it was in Guardians, but there was always the desire to have a big action beat for Mr. Terrific.
I have to say, I was watching it with my wife, and who's not a visual effects person, and she sort of literally at some point went, "Wow!" There's a certain when they come off as they do here, there's an energy, but also kind of like a wonder to those sort of like continuous shots, aren't there?
There is. The thing I have to say, though, is that, you know, James's direction and the stunt team's performance really was doing all the heavy lifting in that particular shot. The whole idea of a new fight style called Groove Fu, where it's you know, kind of a kung fu thing meets a very jive take on kind of things. It was fantastic to watch them shoot it, and all we had to do was sort of add a little flourish here and there and sort of stitch the seams together. So it was great.
I got to believe that's a little bit of an understatement. Like, that was shot over several days, wasn't it? Like, it was, I'm sure, more than just stitching it together in a simple fashion.
It was shot over 2 days. It wasn't as hard as the first one we did on Guardians, which had 12 splits. This only had 3.
Okay.
But they were, yeah, you're right. It was shot over the course of 2 days. So the sun, yeah, obviously it's a totally different day, but one part of the scene shot in the morning, the other part shot in the afternoon, so the sun's in a totally different direction, and you have to hide that fact. So there was a lot of reconstruction work on the ground to make sure the shadows lined up in the right direction so that you can't see the sun swinging around the sky. If we do our job right, then it's invisible, you know, and you can really enjoy the performance from the actors, the performance from the stunt team.
So how much of those secondary characters away from Mr. Terrific and stuff were digital doubles, like fully digital characters? How much were they like stunt guys on wires where you were removing rigs?
There was quite a few stunt guys on wires. Most of the Raptors you see flying all the time are digital. We did take over a few Raptors on the ground just to make sure that when Terrific landed a punch, there was a very visceral connection. So we had to do that on like probably about 2 or 3 of the Raptors, but the stunt team like did an amazing job. And a lot of the people, especially the Hawaiian shirt guys, were not touched by us at all. The stunt performances were, you know, spot on. They had a lot of ratchet pulls that they did. And even in, you know, some situations we didn't replace them at all. When we did, we basically just match moved and replaced them just for, once again, lighting continuity or shadows, but we honored their performance because it was kind of dialed in and spot on. So, you know, there was no need to replace it.
Because there were so many stunts happening one after another, Mike, I was just curious, like how much was that rigged up to be stunt one goes, stunt two goes, stunt three goes, and how much was it, well, we'll film one, then we'll film two, then we'll film three and sort of stitch them together?
The splitting into 3 shots was an accommodation for the rigging of the stunts. They had madly different pick points that would have conflicted with the first, you know, the first setup's pick points. So they whenever they did a cut, it wasn't just because they didn't want to try to run the stunt the entire duration. They actually could run the entire scene. They just couldn't do all the wire rigs. The stunt team was really well rehearsed. But yeah, there was a lot of rig work going on, a lot of wire work going on.
So that's like set in a realistic kind of beach setting, but obviously not far from there is the Pocket Universe, which is can be sort of exact opposite. It's like a completely, nearly completely digital environment. Right? There was quite a bit of still sort of cube, I'm going to call them cubes, jail kind of sets. But basically, that's pretty much all you, right?
Yeah, we there's two major, well, three major components to the Pocket Universe. There's the bismuth, which is all the blue crystalline material that everything's made out of, sort of the natural formations. The art department did make set pieces for that, and they were really beautiful, but they were never going to reflect the right stuff, so we ended up replacing everything. The cube cells, the prison cells, there was thousands of prison cells, so obviously we had to make a lot of them. But we actually ended up replacing almost all the prison cells, because the one thing you can't do in that kind of situation in live photography is shoot proper reflections. There's the digital world you're reflecting into the glass isn't there. So if you put glass in all the cell walls, A, it's a very expensive thing to do because you have to clean it in between every setup and it becomes very time consuming. But even if you did, it would be more of a hindrance for us to paint it out than to put it in. So we ended up knowing that we were going to replace all the glass and all the cells. Once you're replacing the glass, you might as well replace the mullions because you have to have the mullions to reflect into the glass. It just becomes this sort of knock-on effect of once you're doing this, you might as well do that, you might as well do that, you might as well do that. But they had a 3x3 set, 3 cells by 3 cells, so 9 cells in total. It was a huge steel set and allowed them to get the performances of all the actors and cells right next to Superman. The really challenging thing for us is that since we're putting glass in the walls, we had to have every person in every cell to be able to reflect back into their cell's glass and everybody's cell's glass. So there was this process where we turned everybody into digi-doubles so that even if we kept their performance, we put a digital avatar of them to reflect onto all the walls. And it was just one of those things, once you've done the legwork to be able to do all that, if the roto is really bad or if the lighting isn't consistent with the surrounding shots, then you can just go ahead and replace the person with their digital person.
And presumably in terms of digital people, the baby would have been critical.
Oh yeah, baby Joey, he was adorable. Everybody loved him. Legacy Effects did this just absolutely stunning little prop, which, shy of the fact that it didn't have facial expression because it was a puppet. It was camera ready. It was beautiful. We knew we were going to have to replace it just because we had to put performance into it. Performance is very key. It went through a bit of an iteration where it was almost too cute at one point. So we ended up putting scales on it just to try to make it just a little bit more alien. Otherwise, it was almost distractingly cute because it had these, giant, almost anime size eyes. And a head that it weighs almost more than its entire body does. So it's very cute to look at. So we had to sort of tone that down a little bit at times.
And then there was this sort of river element, the end of that sequence when they're trying not to be sort of sucked in. I'm just wondering, like, obviously art department and there's a pre-production and stuff, but like how much was the look really nailed, or how much were you still sort of exploring at your end to try and get that to be something that everyone liked?
A lot. The art department, I mean, James's art department, he's worked with her for a long time, and she's just got a really good sense of what makes him happy. So we started with their sort of foundational work. And we had some videos from music videos that were kind of inspirational, kind of like this, kind of like that, but not. And then you read the script for it, and it's just terrifying because it's just like the script basically describes it as a river made of impossible math. And it's just like, does that mean numbers and multiplication signs flying around? Is it that cartoony? But, we worked on it for about almost a full year before we got a shot done, trying to find the look and hone the look. Early on, we got a test that looked kind of cool. you know, and once again, I call it the James Gunn palette, you know, sort of lavenders, blues, greens, golds. You know, there's this sort of very pastel but very saturated palette that James has in a lot of his films. And we made sure that the river could hit all those colors, and that got us a long, long portion of the way through. But it's not just the colors or the blocks. It's how the river moves, the violence of the river, the, you know, what's dark and what's light. At one point, we had the whole river, you know, so this beautiful, bright, golden river. It looked too much like lava, so we went this really dark, moody, purple river, and then you couldn't see any action. So you're just constantly trying to find the best compromise. And, you know, that kind of stuff takes a long time. And then once we got the river kind of working, we were starting to do a lot of shots. It still felt like a CG river. Because, I mean, it's always going to feel like a CG river. There's nothing that looks like that in reality. But it still felt a little bit distractingly CG, because you could tell that, you know, Superman wasn't in the river. You know, he was in the river, but he wasn't really interacting with the river. So I mean,
I presume all David's photography was well done by this stage, right? So he would have had inherently lighting on him to just shoot with, right?
But, oh, totally.
So totally. You would have had to relighting David as Superman to match in?
A little bit. We tried, okay. As much as possible. Look, there are times where we replace the character with a digidouble so that we can get better interaction with the river. But whenever his performance is key, we totally use his face. We have, you know, with a lot of the modern tools nowadays, you can do really good relighting. So yeah. We could light a digidouble that lined up to him and then steal the lighting from the digidouble and put it onto his performance. So that we're not at all trying to match his performance with the digital avatar. We're just using his performance and matching his lighting to the digital avatar.
Right. So how did you manage to get him looking like he was sitting in the river as opposed to just sort of comped?
The art department and the physical production team did an amazing job. They looked for the best medium to submerge somebody in, right? One idea was you actually fill a pool with water and then you put a sheet on it so that you don't get wet, but you sink into it. That just became way too constrictive. Okay. They tried they had this idea of a ball pit, but the balls were too big. You want the balls to be relatively small. You know, something around the size of a ping pong ball, but then the ping pongs just get crushed instantly because you also want light to be able to come up through the volume of the balls. So they landed on, I'm going to get the number wrong. I want to say it was a million, but it might have only been like 400,000 or something. But the plastic ball that's in a roll-on deodorant.
The deodorant, yeah.
They actually got those from the supplier. So they didn't buy, you know, 700 or 400,000 bottles of deodorant. They just bought 400,000 balls from the supplier. But they worked perfectly because they're resilient. You can stand on them and not break them. You can jump up and down on them and not break them, but they'll transmit light. So they made a pit, you know, it was like about 20 meters long and probably 2 meters wide, this long, narrow pit that they could drag the performers through. And if you stood on it, you would sink down into it. So it gave you, but it also had this, it was like trying to move through mud. It was really, you know, you struggled with it, which was great for the action because the whole point of the river is that it is a violent, heavy river. And if you get stuck in it, you're going to be hard pressed to get back out. So it gave for this really good performance from the actors and from the stunt team. And they did lots of wire work. And basically every shot in the movie had a version that was shot on that set. Oftentimes we replace it based off of camera moves or lighting, but it gave us a fantastic blueprint to start with.
And were there any sort of tricks or insights at the digital level that then sold that shot once you were like obviously removed all the underarm deodorant balls?
Well, that's the point is, I mean, for the most part, when you're doing this kind of movie, you're always replacing the body, right? Yeah. So you're always replacing Superman's body. It saves you from having to paint all the balls off the body. You just match move his body. And then you also get perfect light. If a bright cube passes by the hand, you see the light from the cube onto the hand. You know, we did a lot of digital replacement. The Raptors were always digital. The Raptors being the guys in the green and purple armor. Yeah. We always replaced them digitally. It allowed us to make sure that their performances were just amped up that little bit that you need for a superhero movie. But also it's just one less component that we had to fight the plate with. It's a culmination of two processes coming together to create a result. as opposed to trying to figure out how to fix one or just use the other.
You shot this on the Red Raptor, I believe, like a 8K. Like, what were you finishing at? And also, I think there was an interesting Leica lens that was used, like a kind of, because there was a lot of wide angle stuff. I was just wondering, like, how that sat with you in terms of like getting that feel out of the digital.
Well, first off, I converted to digital early on. I'm a fan of digital cameras. I think that the dynamic range, the you know, what you can do with a digital camera is so superior to what you can do with a film camera. I know there's a lot of purists that are going to say film are fantastic, but to give you an idea, one of the main things that the camera body that they used allowed Henry to do, Henry being the DP, is he had this thing they call the PicoCam, which is basically you take a Red and you put it into a gimbal mount that you can hold in your hands, and they build it in such a way that it's light enough to hold for a long period of time like this. And it allows him to move very fast with it, so that, you know, and it's not, there's not a set of wheels to control the movement of the head. It's controlled by the operator moving the cage of the gimbal. It's sort of slave somehow to, you know, it just softens the movements. So it looks like a steady cam, even though it's just held real quick. It just means that Henry can get from position to position to position very fast and can get camera shots that would be hard to set up in other ways.
It's not that ordinary that the DOP is the camera operator, but like he really likes to get in there, doesn't he?
A lot. Yeah. he likes to get into the stunts. I mean, a lot of the flying shots, Henry would be on wires too. Yeah, he's a rather adventurous cinematographer, but it shows. I mean, you know, the care that he puts into the process is rewarded by, you know, all these fantastic looking shots that would be hard pressed to get another way. Also, his skill, the PicoCam's allowance for fidelity, means that you can get those shots in every shot in a movie and not have to shoot a bunch of boring shots and then set up two really good shots, right? Their pace is breakneck, you know, on that set. They're getting through an amazing number of setups a day, but each setup looks like a bespoke setup. That's one of the things that makes those films look so good. As far as using that on our side, we're a huge fan of the Reds. We've profiled them so that when we render stuff, it comes out looking like it came off a Red. It's really easy for us to work with. The long lens, it can create some problems that you have to sort of consider yourself around, but that's more, it's not a visual effects problem, it's just a cinematography problem. Like if you get a camera really close to somebody's face, it'll look like they're wall-eyed because they're looking straight, but the camera's actually just right here, so the camera sees the eyes looking in two different directions. You know, little things like that you have to be aware of. When it comes to the lens, Henry shoots with a lot of wide lenses. It's a creative choice, so we can easily lean into that. But he did do this one thing where he stripped the threads off the lens. They had a detuned lens on set so that he could just hold the lens by hand and do this. And what it, sorry, you can't see what my hand's doing, but he could just sort of swim the lens around inside the mount. And what it did was it screwed up the focal plane and not symmetrically either. So it allowed him to shoot all the sort of like confused or addled state of Superman with that, so that you get this really kind of parts of the frame are going out of focus while other parts are in focus, but it's not just a depth thing. It gives you this beautiful kind of cinematography. That was a nightmare for us because there's no way. I mean, we do a lot of work to profile lenses and to figure out exactly what focal depth is. And when focal depth is not consistent, even in a single frame, it becomes incredibly hard for visual effects to figure that out. So those shots became manual work.
Hard to track, but I mean, hard to simulate, I guess. Were you doing Were you doing spectral rendering? Like how much were you profiling those cameras and lenses? Was it that level?
We do everything spectral. Yeah.
Yeah. So you had full understanding of every lens's characteristics and every light for that matter. In fact, every filter, right?
Less so the filters. You'd be surprised how few filters get used on films like this, just because it takes a lot of time to move a filter on and off. For the most part, filters are just going to be NDs to allow them to hit exposure, but that doesn't change the spectral nature too much.
Like tracking would be a problem with the with the lensing like that. I mean, I agree that optical kind of manipulation is magnificent, but by trying to match that in the out of the renderer, it just seems like really hard work.
You just kind of go back to what we used to do 20 years ago when we didn't have any of this stuff.
Which is why you want to have experienced people with a good eye, right? Because at the end of the day, if it works on screen, it kind of works, right?
Yeah. We had some great compositors in the comp leads on the team that could figure that stuff out. We did profile the detuned lens, even though you can't profile what it's doing. So we did try to understand things better. We have this thing, it's called PSF. It allows us to profile a lens, how it defocuses, so that we can get the characteristics of the barrel distortion, including chromatic aberration, defocus, non-uniform defocus, so that when a certain defocuses actually are radial. So we profiled every lens on the show that way too. It means that, and it's really subtle, but you put it onto a shot, it just makes the CG look just that more real and settled into the
frame. Yeah.
We did profile those detuned lenses, but
only it's kind of like an like obviously lots of people are used to shooting a lens for distortion on a grid and stuff. But like what you're talking about is like the difference between not adding grain and adding grain made a huge difference back in the day, right? What you're talking about really lets it sit in the shot sort of optically. But boy, that's hard stuff. I mean, those chromatic aberrations in a nonlinear fashion across a distorted lens with like radial distortions and defocus is like, that's some next level math to try and, or as you say, just a really, really clever compositor to try and notice those subtleties and replicate them.
There's some math there. Once you profile a lens, if you know what the focal distance is and the f-stop is, then you can get the same characteristics. It was set up for a show that was done here that had madly, madly detuned lenses, so that everything was smeary and, you know, like they went and found old film lenses from the 70s that had just been abused and then used them because they had really bad distortion effects. But it makes for this beautiful stylized look, but it also makes it really hard to get the CG to sit into it. So they figured it out for that show, and we've been using it on every show since.
So that's all in this world that's like very digital. And then you've got the fight scene out, the kaiju fight sequence, where obviously it's still, you know, Superman, but now we're expecting it to look, the environment to look exactly like Metropolis, which I believe is Cleveland, right, in its location?
It is. We went and shot in Cleveland, which was a blast. Didn't know that Superman kind of originated, like Cleveland was originally Metropolis. Like, you know, so when you fly into the Cleveland airport, there's a big display of Superman and Superman memorabilia. We shot in Glen Morgan Square, which is interesting because way back when I did Avengers 1, we shot the Loki fight scene with Captain America and Iron Man in the same location, but it's been totally redone. But we shot in that square for just around 2 weeks. We shot 1 week principal and 1 week drone footage. We knew early on that we were going to have to do a lot of augmentation because we had this 300-foot tall kaiju walking around the square. So we spent that first week just doing drone photogrammetry, drone plates for everything. And we ended up building the square in very high resolution digital form so that... there's a lot of times, like there's these big screens on the buildings. It allowed us to not just put the screen onto the building and the plate, but actually replace the building with the screen so that when the screen's on this building, you can see it reflected into this building. And you just, all those little details add up. But Joe Davidson and her team did an amazing job of building that thing to just super high fidelity so that we could then, because we knew that once we got into the really big action beats of Superman flying around that area, that the drone just would not be able to move fast enough, right?
Right.
So that we, or because of restrictions on drone flight in cities, go high enough. So we knew that there was going to be at least two or three shots where we would have to go digital. It's one of those things of once you do the city for those three shots, you have it for every other shot in the scene. So we just invested in the city and it gave us a lot of freedom to really play around with the action in the scene.
What's the technical basis of that these days for you guys? Like, I mean, obviously there's photogrammetry, but is it touching on nerfs and stuff now for that drone-based reconstruction?
It would be. Like, this would be a candidate for nerfs if, I mean, there's a few things, right? One, we only want the first two buildings. What I mean by that is the first two buildings in depth. And we're going to replace everything else so that we can make it look like a much larger metropolis, right? So Nurse will only get you so far in that regard. The other limitation with Nurse is, once again, your altitude restriction for the drone means that you can't get all the Nurse that you need. You only can get the Nurse down inside that volume of what you can fly the drone in. So, you know, Nurse, we are using Nurse on other films. And it is a emerging technology, is probably a better way to say it.
You know, the technology has been around for a while. It has the advantage that as I move through the space, the specular responds to the position of the camera, in the sense that it's not like photogrammetry. Basically, obviously, you're not taking it at this level, but at the early stages, it just bakes it in. So effectively, a highlight doesn't move because it's like attached to the building and photogrammetry. Whereas in the Nerf, it's going to be more dynamic. Now, of course, you're going to take it a hell of a lot further than that. But I guess you could Nerf to polygon. Like, there's no reason to stay in Nerfs. You could just use Nerfs and then move out of them. Though. Did you have like a UE5 kind of version for mapping stuff out? Or was there any need to have a kind of a real-time rig for working any of this stuff out? Or was it all sort of previoused out enough?
No, we do. Previous has a low-res version, but we also plussed it up as we changed the layout of the city. We updated the version to match what the city was going to be. But we have a low-res version ourselves so that we can give it to the animation team.
Right. But I mean, you've got real-time playback without having to be in a game engine, right? I mean, you've got, because there's an entire history of Weta's, like, you know, real-time pipeline.
Yeah, but it's in essence, it's a game engine. It's just not a game engine. You know what I mean? It's still right. A real-time engine. So it's the same sort of technology. It's just tuned to what we want it to do.
Right. And so that sequence with the flames and everything, that, like, that's a lot of shots, right? Like at least 100 or so, is it right?
It is over 100.
Yeah. So what challenges did that place with having the kind of fire and stuff? I mean, in one sense, that seems like that sort of well understood ground for you technically, or am I being presumptuous there?
No, you're not. Fire and water are not new to us, right?
Yeah.
But when you're getting into a film like this, it's fire in a new way, is probably a better way to say it. The big change for us, the big thing we identified, you know, when we start a movie, we identify sort of stress points, you know, things that worry us that we're going to put a lot of effort into to make sure that when it comes time to start doing shots, we've got it figured out. And right. For the kaiju battle scene, it wasn't the city. We know we can build the city. That's not a stress point. That's just time. It was the fire and it was the kaiju. The kaiju, because he's 300 feet tall, but there's a lot of shots where you're like, you know, you're like here. You know, the camera is looking at less than 1% of the volume of the creature. So you get into the situation where if it's all got to be, you asked earlier, what do we deliver? We deliver out to 4K. So everything has to hold up to 4K. So if you're this close or if you're this close, you have to be able to deliver a good quality 4K frame. So for the kaiju, we struck on this thing called resolution independence, where we wanted to make sure that whatever we did for the shading and the texturing, you wouldn't get close enough to see the textures fall apart. You know, we had a layered textured approach, we had procedural textures, we had vector-based displacements, we had all these little tricks that we do to try to make the kaiju resolution independent. So when you're pushing, you know, if you look at the entire kaiju, he might be 16,000 pixels of resolution texture from top to bottom. But when you push into the point where you're seeing only 500 pixels worth of texture, it still needs to look like it's 4,000 pixels worth of texture. So, you know, that was one thing we had to figure out was resolution independence. We tackled the same thing when we did this Starro for Suicide Squad. The other thing was fire. Everybody's seen fire in countless movies. It looks really good. A lot of companies can do it really well. But what we needed here was fire that felt like it was 300 feet long, you know, that felt massive. This creature is as tall as the buildings in Glenmorgan Square. There's only a couple of buildings taller than him. He's 300 feet tall. It really has to sell the scale. If we just put a fire sim in there, it's going to, you know, your brain's going to go, oh, it's fire. You know, I get it. But that's not going to be enough. You have to look at it and appreciate the scale and the the impact of it. So that it took, we spent a lot of time making sure the resolution of the sims was high enough, but then we also, it fluid sims have this sort of, if you know what you're looking at, you can sort of spot it. So we had to try to figure out how to break that connection. We had to sort of add more to it so that you felt like there was something new and fresh to it. So typically what you do in a fluid sim is you emit a fuel and then the fuel burns. So we emitted the fuel, but we treated the fuel like a viscous fluid. So we actually did a fluid sim before the fire sim so that we sprayed, sort of like liquid gasoline out. It would actually interact with the air in a blade. And so you'd get a misty version, parts of the fluid spraying out. We set that on fire.
That's the reality of, most people think that petrol is just incredibly flammable and explodes. And of course it is flammable, but it's when it's aerated that it's most flammable. In other words, if you actually had real petrol, you have to vaporize. And when they get the vapor and that's when it sort of explodes and fires. So that sounds like you're doing the same thing, right? You're kind of assuming almost at one level that what's coming out of the creature is yet to be on fire almost, it sounds like. Does that make sense?
Even if we let it all be on fire all the time, it has to do with the inertia of the fuel itself, right? Because typically you're just pushing out a fireball, right? And we're trying to get this fireball to project, 200 feet at times. So we need the fuid itself, the fuel itself, to have enough inertia to keep carrying forward, even though it's starting to ablate and burn. We were lucky enough to find, we looked at a lot of flamethrower reference, and for the most part, a lot of small flamethrowers turn into fire very fast. But there's this video we found of these two guys who set up a flamethrower from World War I. It was a replica of something they used in World War I for clearing trenches, and it could throw a flame like 150 feet. And it was like this super high-powered fire nozzle. Fire hose nozzle, with a huge pump behind it that would pump out napalm just madly, madly fast. And then it would burn. And it was kind of cool because you could see, even though the fire was roiling up, you could see the fluid pushing through the fire, causing the fire to kind of roll along the flow of direction. So it's those little subtle characteristics that really help reinforce the scale of it. And once we understood that the fuel was an important contributor to the result, we started looking at other videos of naval firefighting equipment, which are just water hoses, right? And they're not burning, but it gives us an idea of what the fluid inside the fire is doing. So we simulate that and then we let it burn. So it's sort of separating the process a little bit so that you can get a little bit more reality to it.
Back in the day, and just unpack a point you made earlier, back in the day, we used to have problems with levels of detail, which of course is what you were talking about between the wide and the close-up. And the problem was not so much that you could have different levels of detail, but that you'd be consistent at different viewing kind of points. In other words, the optical characteristics would mean that it kind of looked different, even though it was notionally the same. Under your scheme, both for the flames and for the texturing, did you have any issues in making sure that, even though, of course, it was the same mathematical model, that it looked the same at different scales?
No, that's the entire point of the resolution-independent textures on the creature, is
that it always looked the same.
That it always looks the same, because it's easy enough to paint a new set of textures for a close-up.
Yep.
There are two reasons we wanted to avoid that. One is that we do have shots where we come from far to close, so you don't want to, you can run into that problem where you can see the high resolution patch from far away. So we didn't want to have to try to figure that out. I mean, you can work through that just by massaging it a lot, painting it, looking at it, figuring out that it's wrong, painting it, look at it, and iterate until you get it right. But the other reason we wanted to avoid that as much as possible was that we ended up getting close to about 15 different areas on the kaiju. And to have 15 different high-resolution breakaway sets becomes 15 different creature builds, which, you're only getting paid for one or two of them. You're one with a second amount to help up-res some of it. So, we had to come up with a solution that allowed us that freedom to go anywhere on the kaiju without having to spend a lot of money to work it out. But yes, you're right. It is something you have to consider, is that If you're far away, you don't want to see the high resolution patch. This approach allows us to not have a high resolution patch. The whole creature is just higher resolution.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it works really, really well. And it's, you know, also apart from its technical achievements, it's just a fun film, right? Like, I mean, audiences have been responding to it, and it's great to see that. I guess two levels. Like, one, it's great to see a film that you just enjoy. But secondly, as somebody that's an advocate for the visual effects industry, it's great to see that there isn't some inherent superhero fatigue that means that no one likes superhero movies anymore, because there's so much good work being done by so many artists around the world, especially at Weta. We don't want to see those films go away. So
I can't remember who said it. It might have even been James Gunn. Nobody's sick of superhero films. People are sick of bad films.
Yeah.
And, you know, because we've been making so many superhero films, we've allowed ourselves to get apathetic to the process. The industry has not put out as many good superhero films as it used to. Like, the original Iron Man still holds up. It's a fantastic movie. The original Avengers is still a fantastic movie. You enjoy watching them still. It's the fatigue is just from not creating new ground. And that's what James did with this film. And kudos to him for being such a maestro in this regard. He found a new, interesting way to tell a great story. And it's
how many films have you done with him now?
Including TV shows, I think it's 5 or 6. Let me think through. It's Guardians 2 and 3, both Peacemakers, The Suicide Squad, and this one. So 6. This was my 6th one.
Well, I'm glad that you've had so much success doing them, because we really enjoyed the results. So thanks so much for talking to us, Guy. I appreciate it.
No, thank you. It's great to talk about. I mean, it was a fun film. It really was.
Yeah.
So it's great to get a chance and come and talk about it.
Thanks.
Well, thanks, guys, for that. For those of you traveling to SIGGRAPH in Vancouver, Guy will be part of a presentation on Wednesday morning, so be sure to check that out. Well, that's it for this episode. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening to or watching this FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.